the In the Pattern podcast. Make left traffic, clear for the option.
Minneapolis departure, Archer 641, Charlie 2000, climbing 3000.
Line up and wait, 7 range, 4 Mike Alpha.
Mark Tower, 172, Romeo Hotel, hold short on 133, ready to take off.
Albert Delta, 3621, Mike, entering the downwind for runway 25.
I'm John.
I'm Chris.
I'm Brad.
And I'm Mark.
And we are the In the Pattern Podcast.
Welcome, everyone, to episode 26 of the In the Pattern Podcast. We're excited to be back with you with our stories of flying, some training, and who knows kind of what all is going on. I am your host, Chris Holub, and along with me, we almost had the whole gang. We had the whole gang right up until about 2 minutes ago, and John goes, wait, we're recording right now? So he's gonna maybe join us a little bit later in the episode, but for now, we'll start on the West Coast. We've got back with us Mark Lacoste from NorCal. What's going on, Mark?
Hey guys, I'm glad to be back on here. It's been a while, and I'm
very glad you're back.
I have some good training news, so I'm pretty excited about that too. So
we are stoked to hear about it. Again, I'm Chris Holub here in not so sunny Arizona today. We had a little clouds, but we'll take it. We're in the desert. Any little bit of precipitation we can get, we'll take at this point. I've been doing a little bit of flying, a little bit of this, a little bit of that, and glad to talk about that later. And in the north central part of the U.S., we've got Brad Kane. Brad, what's up, man?
Oh, likewise, been doing some flying. Managed to do one long trip and had a little excitement in IMC and set a new landmark on my logbook.
So excellent.
Touch base on that too.
We have some good content for tonight, and so maybe Pilot Conway will join us here shortly if he can make it. Anyways, so we've all been doing a little bit of flying, so that's good. Weather's been good. Now things are turning to a little cold for you. It's going to be getting back to your winter time. For us, this is peak flying season for me. This time of year, I imagine, is pretty good for you too, Mark.
Actually, it's been great until today.
Yeah.
Kind of. We had that same low pressure system that's coming over you, so we're gonna have about 2 days of wet weather, and it should clear up a little bit Saturday and Sunday. I'm crossing my fingers that it's going to be crystal clear at least half the day. So.
Excellent.
Outstanding.
Well, Brad, why don't you start us off? Tell us what you've been doing, and we'll kind of go from there.
Sure. Like I said, I had a big trip. I took Aiden and I in the plane, and we flew down to Hot Springs, Arkansas, which is about 650 miles or so from here. Yeah, that was a fun one.
A long cross country. Nice.
Very long cross country. It was about 4 hours down, about 4.5 hours back. We had a tailwind both ways. It worked out really, really well. It's by far the longest trip I've ever done. And so there's a lot of planning, that went into it. A lot of dealing with what airplane am I going to have available? How much fuel can it hold? What's the weather look like? Where's the freezing level? Where's the IMC and the turbulence and all that kind of fun stuff. So I really, I ended up delaying about 8 hours from when we wanted to leave until when we actually did leave. It was complicated, but it turned out really, really well. Was able to fly down direct. I ended up getting the Arrow. I was expecting to take one of our Archers, and the guy who had the Arrow ran into bad weather in the direction that he was going into, and he wasn't able to delay, and I was. So I was able to let the big low pressure system that hit New York at the same time that Hurricane Sandy did was coming through the day that I was leaving for Hot Springs. So we had to let that pass. And then once it passed, I was able to make the flight really well. I had to spend a lot of time doing weather analysis, trying to figure out where the freezing level was going to be, what the where the icing was going to be if I had any, what my outs were going to be if I ran into any icing. And that all really fit together quite well. The forecasts turned out to be very accurate. And we were IMC for probably the first hour and a half to 2 hours. And then it cleared up and we were over the top of a big undercast layer and flew the whole rest of the way in the clear. And then completely clear skies by the time we got down to Hot Springs, which made the approach and the landing a lot simpler.
Wow. So it was just you and Aiden?
Yeah, right. Okay. Just the two of us.
Cool.
and our golf clubs.
Yeah, all right. Nice choice of luggage. So
go ahead.
I'm sorry. That was 650 miles or so, you said?
Yeah, 650 miles each way. We flew back and stopped at Excelsior Springs, Missouri, which is about the halfway point. It's on the outskirts of Kansas City, just mm-hmm. east of Kansas City.
That's my old stomping grounds. That's where I'm from.
Okay, right. And so at Excelsior Springs, there's a golf course, and it's right off the end of the runway. And so I was flying in IFR, and eventually I got to within 8 or 9 miles of the runway. It's about a 2,000-foot runway, so it's a little bit short. But I got to the point where I could see the golf course and then I could see the runway. And so I canceled IFR and landed VFR. And I noticed that there was a lot of planes down there and a lot of traffic. In fact, it took me almost a minute before I could announce on the CTAF that I was inbound and inbound and entering the downwind. And I got on the ground and there were a whole bunch of people sitting there. And I thought, well, this is cool. A little old airport. And, with a bunch of guys sitting there and just taking it easy. And I went in and somebody actually came out and guided me into a parking spot, which I thought was really odd. And we got out of we shut the plane down, got out, and they said, oh, well, we're having a big chili cook-off today. And, why don't you guys play your round of golf? And by the time you're back here, we'll probably be ready to have some chili and you can eat some chili and catch up with some people and have a great day. And what a fantastic time it was. So we played a round of golf and I ate some chili, Aiden had a hot dog, and then we picked up and made the rest of the flight home. It was really nice.
That sounds like a great time.
Yeah, you picked the right airport for sure.
Yeah, I had no idea that they were doing that. I just picked it because there was a golf course nearby.
Yeah.
I looked it up on Fun Places to Fly, and they said – said, hey, the runway, right at the end of this golf course, and it's probably 300-yard walk from the terminal to the clubhouse.
Mm-hmm.
So no big deal.
Nice. A day of runways and fairways. Not too bad.
Yeah.
That is cool. Yeah, so how long does it take you to get down there?
It was 4 hours down, about four hours and 20 minutes back.
So in regards to fuel and the aero, how'd that turn out?
I was really glad to have the arrow instead of the Archer. In the Archer, I would not have been able to make the trip down direct.
In one leg. Uh-huh.
Right. I would have had to stop and refuel, or I would have been at minimum VFR minimums. Actually, I would have been below night VFR minimums, so mm-hmm. I would have needed to stop and get fuel.
Yeah.
And so I did. So I didn't have to. I got the arrow. The arrow has 72-gallon tanks, so that gives us a good 7 hours of airtime. So you take an hour reserve out of that for IFR, you get 6 hours of flight time. That was way more than enough. And fuel was really, really cheap at Excelsior Springs. So I only picked up about 20 gallons down in Hot Springs and then picked up 47 gallons in Excelsior Springs.
What's really cheap?
Gosh, I want to say it was $5 a gallon.
Wow. Not too shabby.
Which for, in this economy isn't too terribly bad.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's $5.70 or $5.80 in Crystal.
Mm-hmm. The last time I paid for fuel was like $5.70 something. And then I've flown since then, but I flew a plane that included fuel in the price. So I don't know what it was then.
Right. That little view in ForeFlight where you can pick the where you can display the fuel at the different airports in the region is just wonderful.
Yeah, that's worth it. That's worth the subscription there. It could be, you know, that could pay for it right there if you do enough flying.
It was really nice. And having all the charts and everything there was great too. A few guys in my club and I bought in on a Stratus, and I've used it some, and I didn't have it on this particular trip. Somebody else had it, and I'm kind of in the middle on the Stratus thing.
I don't know if I'm familiar with it.
That Stratus is an ADS-B in receiver for weather.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so you once you get it up to altitude, it will pick up ADS-B weather.
Mm-hmm.
You'll get radar. You'll get ceilings. You'll get wind. You'll get TFRs.
So it's portable?
Yeah, set it up in the dash.
Okay. Not one that couples in with your GPS and all that stuff.
Right. It does not. It has its own WAAS GPS.
Uh-huh.
Which is a lot better than the one that's in the 3G or 4G or LTE, whatever, iPad.
Uh-huh.
And so you get a much tighter signal, but it does not interface with a panel-mounted IFR GPS.
Mm. Okay.
But like I said, I'm kind of in the middle on it. It has, I think, if you do a good weather briefing and are willing to work with flight service, I don't know, I'm kind of in the middle on it. I'm lukewarm. It is definitely not a thing for doing thunderstorm penetration.
We'll see how it goes as time continues and you use it more, if it's something that you like more as you go on.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll see. I wasn't at all uncomfortable making this trip without it.
Mm-hmm.
It's not something where I think, oh, I'm so relieved that I have the Stratus in the airplane with me.
Mm-hmm.
It's okay. But I think if I flew a lot more in harder IFR conditions, it might be more useful. But I do limited trips, and I do a lot of weather prep ahead of time.
Sure. Yeah, well, with that long of a trip, I'm sure you were planning for days on that deal.
Right. I was and with my passenger, with my son who gets somewhat airsick, I really wanted to make sure that I had a good handle on the weather and that it was going to be a pleasant trip for him. And it worked out great. It was bump free. We had a massive tailwind on the way down. It was 45 knots on the tail.
Oh, nice. That made for a nice ground speed bump and fuel savings.
Right. Yeah, it saved a lot of money. It shortened the trip. We were pulling 170 knots. Ooh. Across the
in crew. Wow.
Is that yellow arc?
No. No, it's hard. It's actually really hard to get an arrow into the yellow arc.
Oh.
I was able to do it in the descent, but other than that it cruises at about 130.
Mm-hmm.
And so with the tailwind we were about 175. And then in the descent, I got it up in the 190s.
Ooh, wow.
And that pushed it up into the yellow arc at a 500 foot per minute descent.
Hmm.
But that, yeah, you know, it was, that part of it was great. I broke the 200 hour mark in my logbook on the trip down.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
I have
over 80 hours of dual in my 200 hours, so.
So you got 120 of PIC?
Is 40% of my time is dual received.
Mm-hmm. So is that right, 120 PIC?
No, it's more than 120 PIC because once you're done with your primary, you can log your dual as PIC.
Oh.
So like my IFR training, the 40 hours, roughly 40 hours of dual that I got doing IFR, is all logged as PIC.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you're in actual, you can still log it as PIC.
I see. So, I'm still trying to creep up on the first 100 hours. I think I'm only at like 82, and that's total time.
Right. Yeah, it takes a while.
Mm-hmm.
I find, you know, obviously I do a lot of training flights. 40% of my time is training time, and that's... if I'm not training, I don't fly as much.
Right. Yeah, I keep thinking about when am I going to start my IFR training, and I don't know when. I still don't know when. I don't know. Sometime in the next year, within the next 365 days, I will start it. Right now, I'm just having a lot of fun doing what I'm doing, and I just don't find it being that pressing because I got 300 plus days of severe clear VFR weather anyways. But you know, my ultimate goal is to have my CFI, and I do want to be instrument rated for that as well. So definitely on the list.
Yeah, you can't get a CFI without the instrument rating.
Right. So, you know.
There was a time, but...
And you have to get your commercial.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. And a commercial rating without an instrument rating is really close to worthless.
That's for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe you could do something down here, you know. Grand Canyon flight tours from Deer Valley.
Like for you and I on the West Coast, we could fly for your company or whatever. That's about what it'll get you.
Yeah, right. Well, that sounds great, Mark. I mean, Brad, because I'm going to move on to Mark here. Mark, you are back in the pilot seat. We've been seeing the Twitter updates, and I've been very stoked and excited to hear about them. So finally get to hear some more lengthy things other than what 140 characters will give me. So spare us no details.
Okay. Well, it's been really nice. I can say that I started back my first flight. I'm going through my logbook here as Brad was talking. My first flight back in the cockpit was October 1st, and I figured it was just going to be a meeting with my instructor up at the flight school, and I figured we were just going to do some classroom time just to refresh. And he tosses me the binder for the plane. He goes, go pre-flight. And I'm like, are we not going to talk? He's like, nope. We're going to go break off some rust or brush off some rust in the plane as soon as you're done pre-flighting. I was like, oh,
sweet.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sweet. At first I was thinking, I was a little concerned. I was like, you don't want to talk about anything? He's like, no. We'll go see what you need to refresh on and how good how rusty you are. Cause it, in my book, the last actual flight for training was April of 2011.
Mm-hmm.
So it'd been quite a while.
Yeah.
But so we jumped in the plane, and he basically – it was almost like a – he treated it almost like a check ride slash maybe like a very lax BFR type of ride. And he goes, I'm just going to sit here, and I'm going to let you do everything, and we'll see how it all turns out. And like he goes, just don't get us killed. And so I went through all the steps, and I mean, it was almost like, you know, like they say, jumping on a bicycle. Got the checklist going, and once I started going through the checklist and everything, it was almost like the professional part came in. It was business now. It wasn't mm-hmm. It wasn't playtime. It wasn't joking around time. It's business. I got the checklist, and I went through everything, and made my radio calls, and went out, did the run up, took off, a little bit rusty on the takeoff. Found my V speeds, and we went out into the practice area, and he had me do some power on stalls, power off stalls, steep turns. He goes, "Okay, let's head on back." And I'm like, "Well, okay, if this is like what a check ride's like, I feel a pink piece of paper coming." and he goes, "No, you did fine." He goes, "I just want to see where we needed to pick up from." And he goes, "We'll pick up right where we left off. You're in my opinion, you're good to go to keep continuing." So
nice.
About a week later, I got back in, and we started doing some more work. We did a dual cross country and some more work, and it's been great. You know, I've done so much flying. I think I got 10 hours in the big picture. 10 hours is nothing, but I mean, 10 hours for somebody who hasn't flown in over a year, 10 hours is a lot, because I've not only got back in the cockpit and going through the Jeppesen steps, and we've done a lot and covered a lot of stuff. I'm trying to read some of the stuff in my logbook here, but we did the one that I was finally looking forward to doing, which was the next flight just before I stopped back in April of 2011 was a long cross country. And it's actually, to some people, it may be long. For me, it was long. It was kind of cool, but it's only 104 nautical miles each way. But it's one of the parts of this school is that we do a long dual day, go up and have dinner, and then back at night. And that was one of the trips I heard about early on in my training that I couldn't wait for, because I've always wanted to see what it's like to fly GA at night under clear conditions. And I mean, I did my early on, I had to do the 10 landings at night, and because it was so early in my training, I think I was so focused on flying and flying the plane and getting on the runway and doing everything right that I didn't have a chance to slow down and take everything in outside the cockpit. And coming back on this long leg, it was phenomenal. I got to see, you know, you see all these lights and the cars, and we're cruising along, and you know, some of the uncontrolled airports that we're flying over, he's all, oh hey, you want to see Oroville? Click, 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 and the whole place lights up, and he's like, yeah, the airport manager's probably not happy about that, but but you know, it's really cool. You're flying along, and we turn, you know, runway lights on, and it was just to take everything in, and it was so cool. So in more detail, I could say, for that long cross country, the one thing that I really appreciate about my instructor is he is 100% hands-off with me unless he needs to step in, and very rarely has he had to, which is a good confidence booster for me, because I know I'm okay. Right. And he's a very tough instructor. Go ahead.
Speaking of that, so are you back at the same school you were at before?
I am, and I'm trying to fly a minimum of twice a week. Sometimes that works out, sometimes it doesn't, but I'm up to the point now that I was, you know, joking, saying I hope that Sunday is clear for at least half the day, because that'll be the I want to schedule my solo long cross country that morning. So that'll take me up to that same airport at the 104 miles, one leg, stop at another towered airport on the way back, and then eventually home. And then from that point, we just start doing check ride prep.
Excellent.
So we're really close, and I can almost taste it. So wow. It's pretty cool.
You're on the accelerated track now.
Yeah, and then, you know, and everybody told me that. They said, as soon as you knock out your two cross countries, the check ride is like right there.
Right.
So you're gonna do some, you know, I got to do a little bit more solo, you know, go out and do some maneuvering on my own, and then to prep. So.
There are some new maneuvers for you to pick up too.
I heard that, and I haven't actually checked out to see what they are. But
the inverted tail slide.
Check out the PTS. There's emergency descent, I think, is new.
And that one I can do. That's not a problem. I've trained that one a couple of times.
And I don't remember if there's another one.
I think it's an inverted tail slide. And that other laugh, ladies and gentlemen, John Conway has joined us from the IST.
I have.
He's still there. What's up, man?
I have. Pretty good. You, Mark, that is awesome.
Yeah, it's exciting. Seriously. To finally be back in there.
And you will be amazed at how quickly it goes, because as soon as I started the accelerated track, I mean, it was, a month and a half, and I was done.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So.
And that is so much fun.
You already got all your night done, Mark, or just some of that?
Yeah, all the night part of it, the requirement is all done. So
okay.
My instructor was concerned about that, and he went back and looked at my log and goes, oh yeah, there it is right there, 10 full stops at night, take off and landing at night. So yeah,
you'd already had that done previously then?
Correct. I did that back in 2011.
How about any hood work?
I had quite a bit done too. My previous instructor, who's no longer with the school, he was a firm believer in getting a lot of that stuff knocked out. So get the night, get the hood work. I think I probably need like maybe an hour of hood just for refresher.
Yeah, you'll want to practice that anyways, because the DPE is going to throw the hood on you anyways.
Sure. And I, you know, the only, to be honest, I'm very comfortable, especially after taking this short cross country. I'm very comfortable with navigation, with the radios, with talking to the ATC, with talking to the tower, you know, maneuvering when I need to. Mm-hmm. The only things that I need to work on, to be honest, and it's some of the simplest stuff is short and soft field, takeoff and landing. I mean, uh-huh. that's kind of a precision thing, uh-huh. and because I haven't done that in, you know, over a year and a half, so I need to, you know, maybe next couple times I go up, maybe I'll do a short field takeoff or something like that, and kind of throw it in there on my own.
Yeah, you don't want to forget the flaps when you take off and on your check ride.
Yeah.
I heard someone
keep your hand
that
on the
before.
Throttle.
Yeah. Huh? When you're starting the plane, yeah. Keeping the hand
on a short field takeoff. Put 10 in for a short field takeoff and then forget to pull it back up and halfway through your check ride realize that it's down.
Yeah. At least
I remember you had that happen. You're like
But at least you were the first person to recognize they were still down.
No, he was.
He did.
He started tapping on it.
Oh, okay, that's right.
Because we went to go in a slow flight, and then I went to go up, and then he looked over and he started tapping on the handle, and I was like, "Crap!"
And when you're doing slow flight, and he has you do a turn, make sure you step on the correct rudder pedal,
nice,
so that you don't inadvertently put the plane into a spin. Just saying.
Did you actually spin it?
No, I didn't, but it got everybody's attention in a big hurry.
Isn't that just called a slip?
A slip in slow flight, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That 43 knots.
Yeah.
So I apparently I've missed something recently. What is the change to the PTS? When did this happen?
July 1st it changed, and the one that I know that they added is emergency descent, and I haven't, for obvious reasons, I haven't spent too much time reviewing the private pilot PTS. But it's something to go over. One of the things that I did on my instrument ride was I grabbed a copy of the PTS when I was probably about the same stage that Mark is on his private. And I went through it line by line to see what I was going to be graded on and figure out what I needed to work on. And, there were a pile of things on there that I had never done before. So I harped on my instructor a little bit and, we got those banged out. So I would recommend, you know, just go download a copy of the PTS for the private pilot and find out what all is on there and just figure out the kinds of stuff that you're comfortable with and what works really well for you and what you need to focus on.
It looks like it's an addition of a new runway incursion avoidance task in the preflight procedures is one.
A runway incursion avoidance task?
In the pre-flight procedures area of operation.
How do you pre-flight a runway incursion?
I don't know. There's also an inclusion of runway incursion avoidance criterion in several tasks. Requirement that stalls be above a specific thing, height.
I've got the whole thing here with all the changes highlighted on.
That's what I'm looking at right now.
Okay, cool.
Add a requirement for aeronautical decision-making, risk management, task management, situational awareness, CFIT, and automation management. Of course, the addition of emergency descent task. Wire strike avoidance, some more emphasis on that. That looks like that's about specific details on issuing a letter of discontinuance. And it looks like there's a couple for multi-engine. Engine failure will not be simulated below 500. And for multi-engine, the feathering of one propeller must be demonstrated unless the manufacturer prohibits it. Looks like that's about it.
There is a ton.
You're doing it single engine though, right?
Yeah. There's a ton of stuff highlighted on this one that I'm looking at right now, like checklist usage, temporary flight restrictions, special use airspace, aviation security, single pilot resource management and other areas deemed appropriate to any phase of the practical test. But there's like big long lines. I mean, there's like, seems like pages and pages of stuff that's been highlighted. And this PDF that I got that says that click here to view a PDF version of the PTS with all changes highlighted. Oh my gosh, it was a bunch of stuff. Maybe we'll add this into the show notes. So if people want to take a look at it, they can grab a link.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, it looks like there's a couple of things in here. Automation management as well. So you have to know how to use the autopilot.
Well, you're supposed to know every piece of equipment on that plane. Although, you know, I know when I did my check ride that she didn't ask me to turn on the autopilot. And I don't know. We probably used just about everything else. I mean, the VORs, of course. But speaking of that, on your short cross country, did you use VORs, Mark?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wanted to make sure that I was comfortable navigating with that. Mm-hmm. When we did the dual, I made sure that I could do it. So, you know, dialing them in, how to make sure that that you were on the correct VOR, you know, listen to the Morse code. And I was doing all that and just kind of running through it, making sure that it came time to for the test for the practical that I knew what I was doing. And not having to fumble around going, oh, wait, what am I doing?
Yeah.
Kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
So.
Yeah, I know. When I took my check ride for the second time, I learned a whole lot about the VOR more than definitely learned a lot of things about the VOR on my check ride that I didn't know, or just some techniques more than I guess anything. I had a blast. I like working the VOR, even though it's archaic and compared to just going with the GPS. But it's still fun just to test your skill more than anything, I guess.
And you still need to use it if you start working that instrument rating.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So. I was going to say, I knew that was coming.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because you start doing a lot of like triangulation, stuff like that too, right?
The waypoints you can use the GPS for, but if you're flying a VOR approach, you must use the VOR.
Yeah.
For primary navigation. You cannot use the GPS for primary.
Interesting.
I know one of the other functions that that my instructor was really working me on. We'd get out to an area and he'd say, "Okay, where are you?" And I mean, you look at your chart and you go, "Yeah, I'm right here." He's like, "I want you to verify that that's where we are." And he's like, "How can you verify that?" And you start swinging, you know, radials on the VOR, and you're like, "I'm on this one from here and this one from here," and needles sew them together. And he goes, "Okay, good. Remember how to do that," you know, which was kind of cool because, you know, in practical, you're all of a sudden you're kind of feeling the pressure, you know, and you start to freak out a little bit and
yeah,
you try to stay composed. But yeah, okay, wait a minute. Just do this, be the professional and dial the stuff in. And, you know, if you're not in the right place, and VOR is going to tell you pretty quick.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and I got a little bit, let's say lost on my long cross country. And I couldn't find – I was in the right spot, but I could not find the runway to save my life and needed to do a little quick in-flight navigation because there was, like, no identifying landmarks on the chart except for this airport. Like, oh, great. So, yeah.
Out in the middle of nowhere or what?
Yeah, it was just in the middle of nothing. It wasn't near – it was near a lake, but everything in Minnesota, northern Minnesota, is near a lake.
Yeah, that's not a very great landmark anymore for you guys, yeah.
No, it's the land of 10,000 lakes, and it's actually more like 70,000. So I didn't have an in-flight GPS, so figuring it out with VOR – there was one VOR I could tune, and so I couldn't get – or I could get a line that the thing was on, but that was it.
You know, it's funny you say that you had a hard time finding, you know, airports on the dual long that we did, I guess it's about 3 weeks ago now. During the daytime, we're cruising along, and I know this valley pretty well, but it's when you know, you're seeing it from a different perspective. And I had two of these airports as checkpoints, and I'm gonna be probably 5 miles to the east of each of these airports. And as we're cruising along, I'm like, I know it's here. Where should be right here, and I'm looking for it. And to save my life, I couldn't see two of them. And until he finally goes, he, you know, roll the wing down a little bit, and he'd go, "You see it right there?" And I was like, "That's an airport? Oh, got it. Now I know what I'm looking for." But it was, I felt kind of stupid. You know, you expect that you're flying along and all of a sudden you can see there's an airport right there. And that's really not the case.
No, not at all.
Airports just don't amount to much, you know. They're just not much more than just a strip, so.
A driveway.
Yeah.
And the funny part is Chris Long, we're like 10 or 12 miles away from one of the airports, and he's like, okay, I've got airport in sight. I'm looking around going,
really?
Huh?
Calm down,
I said,
Superman.
Honestly, I don't see an airport. He's like, You know, it's funny, when we did one of our dual cross countries, I went from Auburn, and if anybody wants to look this up, my home airport is Kilo Alpha Uniform November. It's an uncontrolled airport at 1,500 foot elevation. And so it's about 30 miles, 20 miles northeast of Sacramento. One of my dual cross countries that we did, we went from Auburn. We flew down to Stockton, California, the sprawling suburb thereof. And it's a towered airport. It handles, you know, heavy traffic. And we got down there, and I've driven by that airport 1,000 times going down through the valley. Mm-hmm. I'm cruising down, and I'm looking for it, and he's like, okay, 10 miles out. And he's like, and I have to make radio calls to the tower, and we're 10 miles to the north and inbound to land, and we get clearance, and everything is great, and the radio calls are great. And he's like, do you have the airport in sight yet? And I'm like, nope. surrounding the airport is these huge industrial buildings. It's a big commercial area.
Everything looks like a hangar.
Exactly. So I'm like, is that a hangar or is that a warehouse? And he's like, I think you better figure that out. So as we get closer, then all of a sudden the runways pop up, and they have this one massive runway, and then one that looks like a taxiway, which is whichever, I can't think of what it is now, but like 2-5 left or something like that. And we get clearance to land on left, the smaller one. But then we land there, and everything's successful, taxi back, take off. We go to this little tiny town, which is super, super cool. And I mean, if you're into Stagecoach, you know, type stuff, Gold Rush era, we went to this little town called Georgetown. It's up in the foothills. There's a big body of water, and I knew that this was the leg that he had me. He blocked everything off, and he goes, you're going to dead reckon this one. So using your chart, you need to be able to get from this airport to that airport. And I'm like, okay, no problem, because I kind of, the night before, I did my homework, and I pulled it up on Google Earth, so I had some idea of what I was looking for. So I get over this reservoir, and he's like, okay, airport in sight. And he goes, how about you? And I'm looking around going, nope. He's all, you're kind of screwed, aren't you? You better find this airport. So he goes, well, where do you think it is? And I said, I think it's over here about my 10 o'clock. So he goes, okay, let's go see. So I crank it around, and by the luck of anything good, I ended up being exactly on the 45 for the runway as I'm heading that way. And I'm like, oh, I'm on the 45 for this runway. And it happened to be that it's right traffic, so it was perfect. And he's all,
how you had it planned all along, right?
Exactly. I told him, I was just kidding. I knew exactly where we were. He's all, lie. but yeah, it was.
That CFI of yours really got different. Eyes like an eagle, man.
Exactly. Yeah, but I can imagine you fly into an area that you're completely unfamiliar with, and you're especially in a foothills environment.
I was
looking around going, and there's only on this runway, it's only right traffic. So you have to land right traffic I'm not sure exactly what it is, but say, you know, 1-5, you have to land right traffic 1-5. If you're landing the opposite, it has to be left traffic, because there's a huge mountain or, you know, foothill range right on the backside of it.
Right.
So if you don't know what you're doing, you can get in trouble in a quick hurry. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I had, you know, flying up, I had no idea where that was. And that was a little scary. But once, you know, once we're down, I was like, this is a cool little, it's a little walking distance. You go up a dirt trail. We didn't do this, but he's told me about it. And it's like an old rustic, you know, mining town. And it's stayed like that for the last
100 years. It's really kind of cool. So, but yeah, I was real surprised how difficult it was to see some of these airports from a distance. But
you get really good at spotting the beacons at night.
That was another thing, to be honest, as we were coming back on that first night, I think I only saw half of the beacons. There was a lot of, you know, because there's so much other ambient light going on, I really had to concentrate to find one, because you start seeing reflections of headlights. You see the street light, the signals.
Mm-hmm. The, you know, traffic lights, yeah.
Yeah, you see a traffic light, all of a sudden there's a red and then a green or a yellow, and you're like, oh wait, that's not what it is. And then you start to kind of cue into, you know, the rotating flash. It was, mm-hmm. But for somebody who, like myself, was very new to that, it was kind of difficult. And as we were going farther down the valley, it was getting brighter and brighter and brighter as we're coming back into, you know, a major metropolitan area. And then he goes, okay, find home, which is up in the foothills away from all those bright lights. And he says, you know, I'm like, is it those lights right there? And he's like, I think that's Venus on a low setting. I'm like, you're not instilling confidence in me here. He's like, well, just you know, use the. We only have one of the old. I can't think of what it is, but the older GPS. You can dial in the identifier, and it basically is almost like a handheld radio. It's got like the bars, mm-hmm. to the left, bars to the right. So that was it. So I was able to dial that in and kind of follow that. And as we got closer, then I could within 5 miles, I think I finally saw the beacon for Auburn, but it didn't jump out at me by any means.
I had the same problem flying over to Frederick, Maryland, and the problem with that airport is it's right on the edge of the city lights. So when you're coming from the east, I mean it's right on the edge. It's right where that line of lights starts, and it's so hard to see that beacon there. And I had no idea where. I had a pilot with me, and we're looking for this beacon, and we couldn't find it for about 10 minutes. We were about to start circling there too, because it was like, I don't see it.
With 2.5 years in, I was flying down to Hot Springs, and the controller is, you know, asking me if I've got the runway in sight, and I'm like, I don't think I have it yet. And so I did the best trick is you crank the lights up. You know, I gave it 7 clicks and all of a sudden I could see a few lights, but only like a few, only not a whole runway worth. And because the rest of the runway was behind the mountain. So I stayed high and was able to get in that way. But that's if I can't spot the beacon, which I'm pretty good at it because I know exactly what it looks like because it's night all the time here. We're in. Right now, we're getting 16 hours of night, and the days are still getting shorter. So that's a skill that I got pretty good at, because if you fly at all in Minnesota, you're going to be flying night. A good trick if you just can't spot that beacon is just crank the lights up, and it'll be really obvious where the runway is.
That does help sometimes, but I noticed in a couple cases where the runway just from where you're located is kind of hidden behind the trees. So your only hope is the beacon. Or in the case of when I was looking for Frederick, I found that the runway lights actually blended in with all of the road lights around it.
Mm.
So and it, there have been other cases, though.
Your road lights get rows and rows of blue dots everywhere? No, I'm just joking.
Well, most of our runways do not have taxiway lights.
You know,
so there's no blue dots.
Like blue lights running down the whole
the white
length. No,
they're not blue. Mm. No, if they're blue lights, you're landing on a taxiway.
Yeah.
Well, or you work for Delta, one of the two.
Ouch.
Ouch.
But. Mm. No, but I mean, a lot of times that I did find that did help. But there's just the occasional times where trees or something like that, or like a hill or something, will block it.
Yeah, I remember my first night landing, and I had to, you know, you had to click the radio to turn the lights on, and I go boom, 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 like seven times, and they popped on full bright. And I was like, there it is. And I was like diving for it. Let's go, you know. And as I'm getting closer and closer, I'm like, they're too bright. They're too bright. And I'm hitting the thing to turn them down, you know.
Yep, exactly. I clicked them on a night. I did a night dual checkout, and I clicked them on to five so I could spot the runway because I was still 15, 20 miles out. Mm-hmm. And somebody who must have been on the ground because there were no other airplanes – clicked them down to three.
Thanks. It's, you're having remote control wars. Oh man.
And with that, I'd like to wrap up this first half of episode 26 of the In the Pattern podcast. After recording the episode, we found this was quite a long episode, especially with Mark getting back in the saddle. So we decided to break this up into two episodes. So keep an eye out for episode 26 Bravo, which will be out in the next couple weeks around New Year's. But before we end the show, I'd like to take a note and just let you know a few places you can find us or get in touch with us on the internet. You can find out more about the show at inthepatternpodcast.com. We're available on iTunes or your favorite podcatcher. The RSS feed for your favorite podcatcher is on the website. We get a lot of comments about if we have an RSS feed or not, and we do. It's a feed burner feed. So you can find that on our website. You can also email us at podcast@inthepatternpodcast.com. And we're on Facebook and Twitter as In The Pattern. So go ahead and give us a shout and let us know what you think of the show. We'd love to hear from you. So let's go ahead and wrap up episode 26 of the In The Pattern podcast. We'd like to thank you all for listening. Remember, make left traffic. You're cleared for the option.
This and other great shows at the Aviation Media Network.
The Voices in Your Head .com.
Oh, poor John.
Wait, we're doing this now? I thought it was in 50 minutes. Are you kidding? Isn't it 9 o'clock there already?
Yeah, but he forgot that his GMT offset changed, I bet.
Oh.
He was GMT minus four, and now he's GMT minus five.
Everybody just got to move to Arizona. We don't change these time zone things.
I think everybody should just be on GMT all the time.
There you go. Oh, wait. I thought daylight savings time didn't happen until end of October.
No, it was last week.
We are in November now.
Oh shoot! Yeah, you're right. We already did October. See.
It's been a lot of fun. I can say that when I did my thing yesterday, when I turned the paperwork in, my response was, this should not be this fun.
But right. So far, all of this is sounding perfect to me. So maybe,
okay, good.
Maybe my issue has been John's connection the whole time. I don't know. You know, I might take a crack at doing the editing part and then give it back to John to put all the bumper stuff in, the beginning and ending and all that junk.
Cool.
Because I don't see how that can take that long. You just got to listen to it. And I'm not going to be so picky about trying to pick out pops and whatever. I don't know what he's doing with it exactly. But
you didn't have a hurricane.
I'm just going to try and take out the...